Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Michelle Deininger, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Friday, September 24th. Let's start with some weather for our weekend. On the phone with us, we've got Thomas Giboy, meteorologist with ABC4 Weather, with details on our forecast. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Michelle, and happy Friday. This weekend, I think it's looking fantastic. It's going to be nearly Chamber of Commerce weather. So this morning, we're starting off a little bit on the chilly side in Park City with the temperature of 39 degrees and along the Wasatch back. Temperatures are definitely a little bit warmer than what we've gotten used to so far this week. Even for those of you in Heber, the temperature sitting at 36. But for this afternoon, we're going to get an abundantly sunny sky. Temperatures climbing to the lower 70s. So it's going to be a great day if you do want to spend some time outside. And really, this evening is going to be quite comfortable as well. Temperatures will fall from the 70s through the 60s, eventually into the upper 40s for overnight lows under a mostly clear sky. But for today into tonight, don't be surprised if you notice a little bit of some haze from some wildfire smoke, but it shouldn't be as thick compared to what we got to yesterday, thanks to a northerly flow across most of the state. For Saturday and Sunday, both days will be nearly a carbon copy of each other, where both days bring mostly sunny skies, a daytime high around 75 degrees, and an overnight low Saturday night and Sunday night, dropping to around 50 degrees. So if you have any plans to spend any time outside this weekend, I think that you're going to like what you find. So maybe going for a hike, or you just want to spend some time outside with the kids or with the dogs, I think that you will be treated to some pretty nice weather. Now, as we go into early next week, we won't see a lot of changes for our Monday, but we'll likely be moving towards a pattern change for the middle stages of the week. So on Monday, the daytime high will be around 75, 76 degrees, and then Monday night, overnight low of 50 degrees with a sunny sky and then a mostly clear sky. Then a system looks like it's going to be approaching from the west heading into Tuesday. And that's going to result in temperatures going down a little bit, and we'll also add a rain chance to the forecast. So on Tuesday, there will be a slight chance for showers with a daytime high of around 70 degrees. And then Tuesday night, we'll see those overnight lows dropping into the lower 40s, possibly into the upper 30s. So as that system moves in, that will knock down the temperature just a little bit. Then on Wednesday, we might not even get out in the 50s. Daytime high likely going to be in the middle 50s with a chance for showers, maybe a few thunderstorms as well under a partly sunny sky. And then heading into Wednesday night, the overnight low dropping into the upper 30s, lower 40s. And the models are kind of split on what's going to happen as we move into the second half of the week. Some models are trending a little bit wetter, while some models are trending drier. If we stay on the wetter side, we'll see those temperatures warm up a little bit. Meanwhile, if we stay on the drier side, those temperatures will stay on the cooler side. But on Thursday, right now, looks like it's going to be a mostly sunny sky with a daytime high of 63 degrees. So a pattern change on the way for the middle stages of next week. But for this weekend, sunny skies and daytime highs in the middle 70s.
Thanks so much, Thomas. That sounds great.
All right, you have a great weekend.
All right, you too. And on the phone with me, I've got Laura Smith from Mountain Trails Foundation to talk about what's happening outside for the weekend. Good morning, Laura.
Happy Friday, Michelle. Happy Friday, Park City. We don't have a whole lot going on this week, but as we head into the full-blown fall colors, I just wanted to give a quick reminder that if you want to get up to the Bonanza Flat area to do a little leaf peeping or enjoy just the crisp, clear air up there, you might want to consider the Transit to Trails. You can get a free lift up to the Mid-Mountain Trailhead, the Bonanza Flat Trailhead, or the Bloods Lake Trailhead by going to Utah Open Lands and making your reservation to pick up the transit bus to get to the trails. So great way to avoid the parking issues that we have up there on Guard Pass.
For sure.
Also, Mountain Trails crew has just completed a really sweet section of the Mother Urban Trail. And to help it get ridden in, we're hoping some people can get out there and as uphill bike traffic helps to kind of press in the trail. It is an uphill only for the bikes and for the people and the pups. We can get you can go up or down that trail, and this is the last silly market of the year, so maybe a mother urban ride that ends in town could be a great combination. And other than that, we really don't have much today. I just hope people will be safe and nice and have a super weekend.
Well, that sounds good. Thanks very much. Good reminder of everything that's out there for people. Lots of options.
Yeah, sure. And if you have any questions, go to mountaintrails.org or give us a call. We'll be happy to talk.
Okay, great. Thanks, Laura.
All right. Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up at 8:15, I talk to 3rd District Court Judge Richard Mrazek. I'll also be talking to Park City Councilman Steve Joyce and Summit Land Conservancy Executive Director Cheryl Fox, joins us along with author Mike O'Brien to talk about a local memoir about the Huntsville Monastery. So please stay tuned for that. Right now, let's get to some local headlines. Public comment to the Summit County Council Wednesday supported the proposed open space bond for up to $50 million that will appear on November's ballot. At the same time, speakers from the Camas area asked the council for reassurances that spending from the bond won't be siphoned off mostly to the west side of the county. Rick Bruff has more.
To comply with an official state timeline, the council held a public hearing for the proposal, the first countywide open space bond it has put forward. Five people spoke out in favor of the bond, including David Darcy and his wife, Tarina Atkinson Darcy. David said both of them grew up in the Camas area and moved back to retire. He said he was astounded by the development he's seen there. He said he's joined a new group called Friends of the Camas Valley and added the valley, also called the Meadow, is critical not just for locals but for the whole county.
Camas Valley Meadows are not only nice to look at, but are needed for the aquifer. The Camas Valley Meadows aquifer is critical for the Beaver Creek and Weber River water quantity and quality. Westside Summit residents really need to know that they depend on the Camas Valley aquifer for their water. The county needs to be very clear and transparent as to the process of land acquisition before it goes to a vote. If people even start to think that there's going to be forced condemnation or a farmer is not going to be able to farm their land, this bond will go down in defeat in Camas Valley. As to the projected increase in property taxes, this is a definite con, but the county needs to really drive home the point that the $50 increase is only a 1 to 2% increase in total property taxes on that same residence.
Property owner Steve Luzak wondered if the county might neglect the east side in favor of some big ticket land purchases in the Part City area.
And if something comes up like Bonanza Flats or one of these more expensive properties again, and they use the majority of money for one of those projects, kind of leaves the east side out in the cold. And I think that's what people on the east side are asking. How do we get a little bit of guarantee or confidence that it will be pushed to the east side a little bit?
County Council Chair Glenn Wright responded.
I'm not sure I can answer that one, Steve, other than tell you that the east side has been a real primary target for the council in our discussions. I hope you can trust us.
Council member Roger Armstrong also said they were focused on the Camas Meadow when they came up with the bond proposal.
I mean, I think if you look at development pressures in the county, much of the Snyderville Basin is built out, and I'm not sure what those opportunities look like there anymore. There are probably a few, but I think that in terms of, as has been mentioned, the Camas Meadow is something that we have a very high degree of concern about in terms of development and in terms of properties that are selling.
Council member Chris Robinson said it is possible they will use the bond proceeds to preserve land that would otherwise go for development, but the county cannot use eminent domain under the bond. Robinson said a deal will take a willing seller and a willing buyer.
The highest and best use for much of land is development. It's, you know, we say pavement's the last crop. And so by providing a funding mechanism so that there is an alternative in order for landowners who have, you know, have their retirement or their inheritance tied up in their land and the only way to realize the value is to sell it for development, this provides another mechanism, and we've done that many places.
The council has another hearing set next week in Snyderville to allow Westside residents a chance to speak. Some of the speakers from South Summit also suggested a hearing in Camas. The council members said they're receptive to that. Wednesday was also the scheduled time to hear any statement submitted in favor of the bond, as well as an opposition statement. County Clerk Eve Furse reported that by the September 3rd deadline, a statement for the bond had been submitted by Charlie Sturgis and Wes Sidaway. The county did not hear from any opponents, so an against statement will not appear on the county website or in the voter information pamphlet. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Judge Richard Mrazek talked with me yesterday about a problem the courts are having with their move to virtual jury summonses, which are apparently being disregarded by a majority of people who get them. We also talk about jury duty in general as a civic duty, and he touched on a few things people might not know about serving on a jury. So Summit County and presumably plenty of other counties have begun sending virtual jury summonses to people, and they are clearly identified as such and explain everything within them, but it sounds like you are having a significant problem with people either ignoring them or maybe not trusting them. Do you want to explain how severe the problem is with rate of response?
Sure, and I appreciate you asking. So this is statewide. It's not Summit County specific, and it's relatively new. And so anyone that has been summoned as a juror, say, 2 or 3 years ago, would not have seen this yet. The summons is now sent by email instead of in paper form. And there's a PDF that's attached to this 1 or 2 line email that has instructions about how to fill out, among other things, a jury questionnaire. And our response rate on those jury questionnaires has recently been very low, in the neighborhood of 35% to 38%. And that response rate just is too low for us to confidently impanel jurors. We have a lot of jury trials coming up. There are a lot of members of our community that have been waiting for their chance to get a jury trial. And so I need to get the word out that the public can trust these email juror summons that they're receiving, and that we really need them to fill out those questionnaires as quickly as possible.
Okay, so I think I haven't seen one myself, but I'm guessing that part of the problem is the PDF, because people have been conditioned in recent years not to open unfamiliar attachments and to be suspicious of emails that look official but might not be. So what about possibly trying to configure it so there's not a PDF? It's probably something you've already thought about.
Well, that's a great suggestion, and we suspect that much of the reason we have a low response rate is because of that reasonable suspicion and people acting conservatively, or just because maybe the email is getting caught by their spam filter. I don't get to make choices about how the system works. It's designed at the state level. And I will say that in other counties, the response rate is better. So it may just be that we haven't done a good enough job in Summit County to let people know that this is real. They can trust it. And they can also trust that the court will never ask for things like Social Security numbers. We will never ask for things like bank account or financial information. And the PDF that it's attached is a PDF, just like you'd get from the school district or maybe your local health department or water authority. And so it's the type of attachment that I think you can trust and that you have likely trusted in other types of emails from other governmental entities.
How about explaining why you switched to virtual and when that switch was made briefly?
So the switch occurred after the red phase shutdown of jury trials at the outset of the pandemic, and we designed a new system that would allow us to perform the function of jury selection, which involves grouping together 40, 50, maybe 100 jurors, but allows us to do it without the jurors having to come to one place and sit in the same room. So unlike the old days, where you'd have to spend a morning at the courthouse sitting in the jury room or the courtroom answering questions with 40 of your neighbors, now you can do it from your office, you can do it from your kitchen table. You will not have to come to the courthouse for jury selection. Rather, you'll just log in to a WebEx video conference. But the first step, so that we know that you can be qualified as a juror, is to fill out this questionnaire. And if we don't get a questionnaire back from you, we will not send you the WebEx link, because we don't know if you are actually present and we didn't get the information we need. So it's designed to be a better system, but it does require a little more engagement from the potential juror up front.
Those emails are doing battle in people's inboxes with so many dozens of things that people don't want or need that are not from legitimate sources, obviously mostly retail sales type stuff. What is the subject line and the from field?
So the subject line will be something almost identical to Utah District Court Local Juror Notice and then your name. And then the substantive from field will be something similar to jury@utcourts.gov. It might say summitjury@utcourts.gov. But the important piece there is the utcourts.gov URL. That's how you know it's a trustworthy source. It will say jury in the from field. And then the body of the email will say your Utah State juror number is blah, blah, blah. Please see the attached document for further instructions and or information. And then there will be a PDF attached. And we have examples of those that we've provided to KPCW, both the email and the attachment, so that if people have questions, they can compare what they're receiving to what we've given to the radio station.
I was looking over the contents of what's in the email or in the PDF when you click through, and there's a sentence that says, serving as a juror is one of the highest duties of citizenship, and we sincerely appreciate your timely completion of this next step in this important process, which I thought was such a good encapsulation of the role of serving as a juror as part of one's civic duty. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think jury duty gets such a bad rap?
Well, I can understand that it's a real pain in the butt, right? I mean, people order their lives and they're busy and they have kids and jobs, and they get a letter from the court with 2 or 3 weeks notice saying that careful order that they've put into their lives now needs to be set aside. My experience is once they show up, and if they are impaneled, every juror I have ever experienced takes it very seriously, takes their role very seriously, and does a great job. And so while I can understand that it's a pain in the beginning, we really appreciate the hard work that all potential jurors and impaneled jurors put into the process. And it's important to remember that this isn't an academic exercise. There are defendants who are presumed innocent, waiting for their chance to have their innocence vindicated. There are victims who have been hurt through crime, waiting for their chance to tell their story. They've had to wait for a very long time because of COVID. We have a long slate of jury trials that we need to go forward with, and we really need the community's help to make it happen.
All right. I have never served on a jury, and therefore I don't know this. What are the specific qualifications to be a juror?
Well, among other things, you have to be 18 or older. You have to read and speak the English language. You have to make sure that you are not a convicted felon. You must not have a physical or mental disability that would make it impossible for you to sit for long periods of time, pay attention to the evidence, hear or see the evidence. Those are the issues, among others, that we're asking about in the questionnaire. We also need people to be honest about whether or not they have specific viewpoints that would be hard for them to set aside. We need jurors to be impartial and to make decisions based upon the evidence and the law only. And there are some people who are admirably candid about the fact that because of certain viewpoints that they genuinely hold, there are just certain issues they cannot, they just can't consider impartially. And we need people to be honest about that. That doesn't make them bad people. We just need to give them, we need them to give honest answers so we can determine whether or not they're disqualified from being a juror.
Mm-hmm. What are the most typical legitimate reasons people are disqualified from serving?
We often have medical reasons. Sometimes people have impending surgeries. Sometimes they have medical needs that we cannot address in the courtroom. Sometimes we have nursing mothers who just can't be away from their newborn for that length of time. Other times they will have some kind of personal connection to the subject matter of the case or to the parties in the case, which creates at least an appearance of bias that would not be could not be overcome. Those are the issues that most often come up.
And how often are people over 18 asked to serve, or how often do they receive summonses? Did you say every 2 to 3 years, or is it less frequent than that?
Well, it depends on the pace of jury trials that the court is doing, and we have to make sure that we're not comparing Summit County with approximately 42,000 people to, say, Salt Lake County, which has considerably more. So here, you're likely to get that The first step in the process is a juror qualification form, and historically Summit County has sent those out every 6 months. So you may see those fairly often. But actually getting summoned to appear for jury selection, until recently, I imagine in this county, happened relatively infrequently. The current issue is that we have a backlog of jury trials that we have been unable to do during the pandemic. And so people may find themselves being summoned more often than they historically experienced for the next year or so. And then I imagine it'll go back to normal.
So sounds like you're going to be busy for the foreseeable future.
We try to stay busy.
I was hypothesizing that a more common reason to not be, maybe not to not qualify, but to ask to be recused would be economic. People that are heads of single income households that can't take time off work. Is that just a completely different category of conversation from qualifications?
Yeah, the court uses qualifications very specifically. What you're describing would fall under the heading of hardships. And there are certainly times when a person's financial condition or, say, their family structure, single mom without family in the area, or should say single parent, mom or dad, without family in the area or a support structure, they may just not have the ability to sit in the courtroom for 2 days because they have childcare needs. We certainly consider those issues on a case-by-case basis, and when it is extraordinary, we make accommodations and do not impanel that person.
But it sounds like perhaps that's not as common or frequent as I was thinking.
Well, I don't want to give the suggestion that because serving on a jury will cause disruption of your normal life or disruption of your normal employment, that by itself is sufficient cause to not serve. That's inevitable. We understand it's a sacrifice for members of the community to serve on a jury, but it's a very important sacrifice, and it's one that we appreciate and value greatly. And so some of the sacrifice is unavoidable. Extraordinary impact, hardship, or sacrifice is certainly something we take into account.
Okay, so when people have issues that they think may prevent them from being able to serve, you take that on a case-by-case basis. That makes sense. You mentioned someone sitting in court for 2 days, and I wondered, is there a typical trial length, or does it just vary so drastically that you can't say?
It does vary drastically, but I think if we were to do a graph of the most likely length of trial, it's 4 days or less, with 1 to 2 days being the most common.
That's shorter than I thought. I don't know why. So that's good information for people.
Yeah, it's most of the trials that we do are criminal trials, and most criminal trials are shorter than civil trials. Criminal counselors are very, very efficient. Now, the civil trials can often be longer, and there are certain criminal cases that are more complicated that just require more time. But in my experience over the last several years, 1 to 2 days is most frequent. I haven't yet seen a trial that went more than 1 week with very few exceptions.
All right. Well, I think that's probably going to be helpful for people to think about. If they wind up serving, it's perhaps not the kind of commitment that they see on television shows, for example. You need people to fill out their summons. Open your email, fill out the qualification survey, and lend a hand as the courts seek to lessen the backup. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that I haven't asked you about?
If people have any questions, if they're not sure if the email they got is legitimate, if they're not sure they're using the right link for the jury survey, if they're not sure when this jury trial that they're being summoned is going to occur and how long it's going to last, they should not hesitate to call the courthouse and ask all of those questions. We are here, normal working hours every weekday, and we are happy to answer any questions. I would much prefer that the phones ring off the hook with people who are interested in doing their civic duty but have questions, rather than have people ignore the correspondence from the court on any case.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Judge Mrazek.
Thank you for your time.
That was Judge Richard Mrazek of Utah's 3rd District Court. In the studio with me is Park City Councilman Steve Joyce. Welcome.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing well.
Should we start by acknowledging that this might be the last time you're sitting in that spot, at least in an official capacity?
Yeah, this is my last post-council meeting wrap-up. So, good news, bad news.
Yeah, all right, well, dazzle us. Go out with a bang. Let's talk about last night's meeting. You said it wasn't terribly long.
No, for us, going from 4 to 7:30 or 8 is a good short meeting, so.
Absolutely. All right, let's jump in. According to the staff report, all Judge Tunnel water will be diverted to the new Three Kings Water Treatment Plant by 2024, drying up the creek. Looks like that was a decision made a long time ago. How much can the council really do about it?
Yeah, There's things we can do, but they're very complicated and very expensive. I mean, the bottom line is we've got from Judge Tunnel, you've got a lot of water coming out that's going through the mines. It's full of all sorts of different types of metals, and the EPA wasn't terribly happy about that. And so as part of the Clean Water Act, you know, we aren't allowed to dump that water in to the creek anymore. So a couple of years ago, we built a pipeline that runs from Judge all the way over to the new Three Kings Water Treatment Plant. But while that water treatment plant's being built, we're letting the water flow in. And so we have an exception from the EPA to do it during the construction period. But starting, I think it's right at the beginning of 2024, we have to have switched it over. And we're certainly on track to do that. But the creek will still flow. It's not that it'll dry out forever. It'll go back to what it was back in 2012, 2013, which is a seasonal creek. When the snow's melting, it'll run, you know, probably July, August, if we're having a dry one, it'll dry out.
Okay, so you heard from members of the public who are used to it. They don't want it to go away, and you were a little frustrated at the current situation, exploring whether the city could keep water flowing in the creek. You want to address that?
Yeah, it's just a tough one. We've spent a lot of time in the past, you know, for my 3.5 years on council, and certainly before then, being a, you know, kind of a very environmentally aware community, and we've talked about that. And every time we go out and do visioning and stuff, it's one of our real focuses, our high priorities. And in fact, it was kind of interesting that the next thing on last night's agenda was talking about water conservation. And to turn around, if you look at the amount of water flowing down that creek right now, it's about 900 gallons a minute, which is about 1 million gallons a day. And so when we talk about what we would have to do, we would literally have to treat the water to stream standards, which oddly enough are more rigid than drinking water standards, and actually treat it that well and then pump it back up there. And 1 million gallons a day is about full bore for a golf course. Only, you know, it's a year-round thing. And so I was just kind of struggling with, hey, I know everybody likes a creek running through town. We always joke about on our leadership tour about everybody else has a river. We don't have a river. But 1 million gallons a day, man. And, you know, and a lot of the conversation really started around the wetlands that you see down by the rail trail when you get kind of headed out towards Quinn's Junction. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a requirement from the EPA that we put additional water into those wetlands to keep them healthy. But we can do that out of something called the Homer Ditch, which is out of the Park Meadows area. And that's no treatment, no pumping, no anything. It's easy, quick. And we've already agreed to do that back in 2013.
Okay, good explanation. So let's stick with water. Let's talk about the water conservation issue. You had concerns about current water rates and how they're calculated for commercial businesses. What do you think needs to change?
We did an exercise, kind of we council before my time, to start getting a little bit more aggressive with tiered water rates. So the people who use very little and conserve pay very little per gallon, and the people who are egregious users and, you know, water their lawn 7 days a week or whatever, and have a lot of turf, they end up paying a lot. But the things that we put in place, our base rates are pretty high. And so I'm the president of a little HOA up on the hill here, and we've been trying to figure out how to do xeriscaping or some version of that. And our base rates are so high that it makes it hard to cost justify it. So that was the start of the discussion. But it turns out that there's another opportunity here that, as we've looked, we kind of did this tiered water pricing for the single-family homeowners, but for irrigation, for commercial, and for multifamily, so everything from, these apartment complexes, condo complexes, that kind of thing, they really aren't tiered at all. They're just flat rates, and we really haven't done the same thing. And sure enough, single-family has started doing a lot more conservation, and commercial and multifamily, and those haven't done nearly as much on an account-by-account basis. And so I think it's time that we go back and look at our rates again and try to encourage conservation and try to more equitably spread the pain of trying to conserve.
Okay. Let's get into the Parley's Canyon fire review, please. You got an in-depth report on the response to that fire. It sounds like the postmortem was mostly positive.
Oh, I think it was really all positive. It literally, I mean, for the people, you kind of saw the end result. I mean, we all got kind of wired into it after it got going. But to see kind of a quick timeline, not of the 3 or 4 days and then all the cleanup and everything, but to see the timeline of how quick the response was in the first handful of hours of, you know, going from just a call into 911 kind of thing to vehicles rolling from Park City and vehicles rolling from Salt Lake and planes coming in and then big planes coming in. And you know, we think about how government tends to move slowly sometimes. This was stunning at how well prepared the fire departments were and how well they cooperate at not only just kind of a local Salt Lake Park City kind of area, but a regional thing. We had planes flying in from Idaho and I think Colorado and somewhere else. Almost instantly, it was stunning.
So much went right, and we're so fortunate that we didn't lose any structures. Was there any talk about sending emergency alerts in Spanish, which emerged as an issue after that weekend?
Yeah, there wasn't last night, and I regret that. That would have been a good comment, but I think that's really, you know, what we had last night was the fire department. I think that's really something that we need to go back and talk to the emergency management piece of, you know, we've got Mike McComb here in the city, but we also have the counterpart in the county. I think that's definitely a requirement that we need to address, and I really don't know enough about what needs to be done to get it fixed, but it needs to get fixed.
Okay. So, speaking of wildfires, city's set to begin wildfire mitigation work on Treasure Hill next week. What is that going to look like? What's being done?
So right now, it's kind of the first phases. I mean, we're going to get up there. We're going to start doing a little bit of work, but a lot of it's the planning work, the exploring, the mapping, figuring out exactly what needs to be done, what we can remove, what access we have, that kind of thing. Probably the more exciting thing for the community is we've done some mitigation work this summer, and it's kind of up behind Rossi Hill. You could either get to it coming up the hill from Marsac or coming up on the Rossi Hill side, and there's about a half dozen burn piles there, and we talked about this in our retreat on Tuesday, but I'd really encourage everybody to pay a lot of attention to this, because this winter, late fall, we ought to be doing our burning not only for us in the city where we did work, but also Deer Valley. Valley has done a lot of fuels mitigation, and they need to start burning some of their burn piles. And so it's something we're not used to. They've done quite a bit of this out by Summit Park in the past year. But in Park City, we're just not used to seeing fires go without panicking. And the answer is there's an incredible number of controls and permitting and days you can do it and days you can't, and the fire department there and all that kind of stuff. But everybody, please keep your heads up, because this is coming.
And we are lucky to have Fire District keeping close watch on this.
Yep.
So, council also received an update on the pandemic from County Health Director Phil Bondurant. You had some back and forth with him about the case thresholds for the public when it comes to mask mandates. Were you satisfied with how that shook down?
Yes and no. I think Phil's doing everything he can. It's frustrating to look at this from a state level. you know, we really got an education back as the first waves of the pandemic started, and it was all about balancing between keeping things open and, but you can't overrun the health system. And so, you know, as even as caseloads went up, the answer is, as long as they were, you know, a lot of it was from extra testing, people were asymptomatic, and you saw the caseloads go up, but the hospitals were still in good shape. Now, that's really not the case. I mean, the ICUs are full, they're full of COVID patients, and we're not doing anything at the state level. In fact, they've legislated that you can't do anything. And that's frustrating. I mean, I think everything but two counties in the state as of yesterday were in the high transmission rate, which would have had a lot of restrictions in the past, and now there's nothing. So I think Phil's doing all he can. Summit County's doing all they can. But man, the state just seems to be kind of sticking their fingers in their ears and ignoring things.
Yeah, they have legislated on this to remove some of the controls that...
Yeah, I mean, they basically, by law, said the pandemic is over back in April, and clearly the pandemic is not over.
So, Councillor Doylny commended PCMR for requiring vaccinations for their employees, saying they set the standard for local employers, and obviously a number of organizations and companies have done the same. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think this is the case that we're going to have to rely on this as a community. If the state is not only going to not take action, but prevent the counties and the health districts from taking action, then we're really going to have to look to our you know, business interests and stuff as the leaders, and not just businesses, but nonprofits, the city and county, and both by example and by requirement. I think that's what it's going to take. And as Max pointed out, he owns the Corner Store and Corner Sports right there at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. And, you know, it's a lot easier for them to do the right thing if Vail's doing the right thing. And I think that same thing applies with Deer Valley as well. They've had a mask mandate in place for a good while.
I hear you. All right, so we're just about out of time. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on today?
Yeah, there's one that I would appreciate some help on. We have got something that our internal units, that this is going to be a change that... internal accessory dwelling units. And so this is a dwelling unit in the house, and we've got a survey that we need help getting filled out. And so if you turn around and look at engageparkcity.org, if you have any interests in having an accessory dwelling unit in your house, or you're really worried about having those in your community, then please go to engageparkcity.org. You'll see it on the front page. Fill out the survey, and that's going to help us change our land management code with the Planning Commission.
All right, that's excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Have a good day. That was Park City Councilman Steve Joyce. Joining us by phone are Ogden native writer and lawyer Mike O'Brien and Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. The two have in common a passion for the historic Huntsville Monastery, which is the subject of O'Brien's memoir, Monastery Mornings, My Unusual Boyhood Among the Saints and Monks, and which the Land Conservancy is in the process of securing a permanent easement to protect. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike, I'd like to start by giving listeners a window into your book. Monastery Mornings describes how a small, insecure boy with a vibrant imagination found an unlikely family in the company of monks at Holy Trinity Abbey in the mountains of Utah. Your memoir came out earlier this year, and it's a happy coincidence that it's serving to tell the monastery's story to newcomers and younger generations, which is timely given the Land Conservancy's work. Can we start by hearing a little bit about how the monastery was founded by World War II veterans?
Yes. In 1947, their mother house, if you will, in Kentucky was overflowing with new candidates for the monastery who had joined in the aftermath of World War II.
Excuse me, Mike. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Your connection is a little rough. Could you try moving to a spot maybe where we can hear you better?
Yes. Is that better?
That is much better. Thank you. Continue. Sorry.
Oh, good. Sorry about that.
No problem.
So in 1947, the monastery in Kentucky from which the Utah Monastery originated was overflowing with men who had joined after World War II, and they needed to start a new foundation because they just didn't have room. And so they scouted out a spot in Utah, and on July 10th, 1947, 33 monks from Kentucky arrived at the Union Station in Ogden and took a bus up Ogden Canyon and started a new monastery that lasted there for 70 years.
So tell us how you wound up so connected to that monastery in your youth, please.
Yes. So when I was 11, my parents got divorced, and my mom, you know, good Irish Catholic girl from New England, was sort of looking for stability in her life and for me. And one day we drove up to the monastery. I think she was hoping I'd find some good role models or some, you know, men who could be good examples in my life. And the monks kind of adopted us, and I worked on their farm and their bookstore and became friends with many of them, and spent the next 10 years before college up there 2, 3, 4 times a week. Very, very wonderful experiences.
So hard work, but work you loved. Some of what I read about the monastery described agricultural production as a form of prayer and devotion for the monks. Did you see and experience that up close?
Yes. You know, the monks, they had a wonderful farm, a dairy operation, a cattle operation. But, you know, when the bells would ring, they would stop what they were doing and go chant and go pray. One of them used to say that every time they lifted a bale of hay, it was a prayer. So they like so many of us fail to do, they integrated their work life and their spiritual lives in very unique and special ways.
In your memoir, you write about the particular solace and healing that monks helped you find after an assault, which is powerfully personal and also may offer a message to victims about ways forward after a tragic event. Do you want to talk about the role they played in helping you that way when you needed it?
Yes, and it's kind of ironic, you know, that they would play that role given, you know, the current scandal involving, you know, a small but unfortunate number of Catholic priests and their behavior towards children. But for me, it was the exact opposite. I was assaulted when I was young, and they were a source of support, encouragement, friendship for me. You know, I one in particular, I met and talked with him about the situation, and he provided assurance that I, you know, needed to understand that it wasn't my fault, that it could have happened to anybody, and that, you know, brighter days lay ahead. Just some remarkable sources of, you know, spiritual therapy, if you will, as well, mm-hmm. You know, for a boy who was hurting and somewhat lost. And always grateful that I had them in my life at that critical time.
Cheryl, the Summit Land Conservancy and the Ogden Valley Land Trust are partnering right now to preserve this property. How did your group come to its involvement in this piece of Utah's history?
Well, the monastery property is iconic in northern Utah, and there are a lot of people who had visited the property, you know, over the 70 years when it was there. The monks would sell honey and bread, and it was also possible to go and sit in their little chapel and listen to them chant. So it was a well-known property, and as the monks aged and it became evident to the Catholic Church that they were not going to continue having the monastery on this property, the church was looking at other options, which primarily involved selling it to a developer. And there was a man named Bill White, who is not the same guy as owns the restaurants here in Park City, but a different Bill White. And he found out that the property was going to be sold, and he had already done or was in the process of doing a conservation easement on a different ranch that he owned with the Summit Land Conservancy. So he was familiar with conservation and how it worked. And when he found out that the monastery property was at risk of becoming a sea of homes, he and his partner, Mark Wangsgard, Winston Wangsgard, got together and said, let's just buy it and we'll take it off the market and then we will conserve it. And that is what they managed to do. They had to go and buy it from the Catholic Church. And then they approached the Summit Land Conservancy and said, okay, can we put a conservation easement on it? And we knew that there was a volunteer, all-volunteer land trust up in the Huntsville area. and that they also were interested in seeing this portion of, you know, it's right in the heart of their community to see that preserved. And we just felt that this was a great opportunity for us to partner with that organization. They don't have staff, so they didn't really have the capacity to go after a big federal grant, which was necessary to save this land. And the Summit Land Conservancy does. So we did go after the big federal grant. We found out in, I think, December last year that we were awarded that. And then the Ogden Valley Land Trust has been doing a really great job fundraising from the community up there. And donors have also been giving to the Summit Land Conservancy. So we think we're pretty close to being finished, and we're working on actually getting this conservation easement placed on a little over 1,000 acres before the end of this year.
All right. So what is the appraised value of the property?
So it is being reappraised right now. Our initial appraisal brought it in. The value of the property, if you were going to go buy it and put homes on it, is north of about $22 million. It's being that was a 2019 appraisal. We need to get it reappraised right now in order to close on the transaction, and we think it's going to come in significantly more than that. The value of the conservation easement was about $21 million. The landowners have agreed to sell us the conservation easement for a fraction of that, which is pretty amazing. It really speaks to the generosity. I got to say, this land is, it's amazing. I think that the work of the monks over the years and their attention, their spirituality really infused that place. And people feel it when they go there. And it's truly a remarkable place. And we're really honored to be working with Bill and Winston and our other partners, and hoping to preserve it.
So, Cheryl, your organization has highlighted the importance of the land, not just to people and to Utah's history, but also to wildlife, biodiversity, and watershed health. It's home to endangered species. Many species winter there, and it also offers seasonal wetlands for migratory birds. It's like the animal equivalent of Manhattan. It's got so much going on there with wildlife. Would you talk about some of the specific species that would benefit most from its conservation?
Well, one of the interesting things about it is the elk, actually. And over the years, one of the things that the monks started and the current landowners have continued is, you know, it's in hay right now, but they don't take a second cutting of hay off the property. And so at this time of year and through the winter, the elk tend to come down and really enjoy that that space in that property. There are a host of birds, raptors. It's really it's an incredibly beautiful and powerful place. And I think, you know, Mike also spent a lot of time there, so he can probably speak to it as well.
I did want to ask Mike a couple more questions. Mike, I also was reading that some of the monks live in Salt Lake City now since the monastery itself was closed. Do you have ongoing relationships with them? And do you know if anyone has read your book yet of the monks?
Yes. Fortunately, I am still friends with them. There's five remaining monks. They live at a retirement home in Salt Lake, and we see them regularly. We take them, actually, my wife and I drive them up to Huntsville, and Bill White, who Cheryl referred to a moment ago, hosts them on the monastery land and at his home for barbecues. They love his wife's potato salad. We also recently took them to lunch in Salt Lake City, and I gave them each a signed copy of the book, and they were pretty excited. They're so modest, you know, they wouldn't tell their own story, that I just was delighted that I could have a role in helping to tell their story for them.
And your book signing for this memoir is October 1st, is that correct?
Yes, October 1st, 5:30 p.m. at Dolly's Bookstore on Main Street in Park City.
All right, excellent. Cheryl, is there anything that you want to let people know who may be interested in getting involved in this effort once they've learned about it?
People are welcome to visit our website, which is wesaveland.org. And right there on the front page, there's a more information about our partnership with Ogden Valley Land Trust and our work to save the land. And then I would also encourage people to join us at Dolly's on not this Friday, not a week from today, October 1st at 5:30, and meet Mike. And we'll be there, too, to talk about the work that we're doing.
All right. Mike, was there anything else you wanted to add?
Just quickly, you know, when they arrived, the monks called that place a little bit of heaven. And their abbot said, you know, let's strive to make it so. And they did. They built a little bit of heaven on earth up there. And I'm so thrilled that people like Cheryl and Bill are helping to preserve it. It's a wonderful place. And appreciate the chance to come on your show and talk about it.
Thank you both so much. Good to learn about that.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Mike O'Brien, author of Monastery Mornings, My Unusual Boyhood Among the Saints and Monks, and Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. And Mike's book signing at Dolly's is October 1st.